From the headquarters of the American Radio Relay League in Newington, Connecticut, this is ARRL, The Doctor Is In, a bi-weekly podcast addressing common and some not-so-common technical issues in amateur radio. This podcast is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. And now, here's your host, QST Editor-in-Chief Steve Ford, WB8IMY, and the Doctor himself, QST Contributing Editor Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Hello, I'm Steve Ford, WB8IMY.
And I'm Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Joel, kits are as popular as they've ever been. In fact, for many people, kits are the way they get started into amateur radio. It's usually an affordable way to get going, to build your own kit. Plus, there's the satisfaction. That's what I love, putting power to a kit that you built yourself. It springs to life, you hope, without releasing
sometimes
without releasing smoke in the process. And voila, you have this radio that's working on your bench that you put together with your bare hands. So I'd like to address kits. Kits themselves generally, but also whatever kit building tips you might have, because I know you've done this a lot.
I have. It's true. Many of my radios came. In fact, I'd sort of forgotten where I first started with kits. My father got me a Meisner regenerative receiver kit when I was about 12, and had plug-in coils, and it was interesting. We built it, and it didn't work. And my father, who was an engineer, looked at it and said, "Oh, they forgot to put in this wire in the instructions." So that's, that's the only time that happened. I've had other problems with kits, and I guess my first ham receiver was a Heathkit ham receiver. My first ham transmitter was a Heathkit transmitter, DX35. My first sideband transceiver was an HW101 Heathkit transceiver.
Oh yeah, the famous hot water 101.
You bet. So I've had quite a few over the years. They've all been interesting, and they all saved a lot of money. At the time, you could pay about half of what you would for an assembled thing, and that made a big difference for somebody who had to mow lawns for some of this money and so forth.
You bet.
But I think before we talk about kit building, I think a good place to start is to talk about kit buying. Many, and perhaps most, companies that offer electronic kits have an internet web page that includes the ability to download and print their assembly manual. And I strongly recommend that if you're considering a kit, that you do that first and then go through each of the instructions carefully, imagining that you were performing the steps. When you get to the end, if it all seems like something you can do and the tools that are needed are tools that you have or have access to or you're willing to buy, then you can feel comfortable proceeding. Back in the days when I was doing it, of course, we had tube sockets and wires and wrapped resistor leads around tube socket pins and so forth. Very straightforward to do. You had to make sure you got the right, you know, you could count up to 7 or 9, and you could identify resistors and identify the hardware and, you know, that kind of thing. But nowadays, there's such a variation of kits. A lot of people have trouble with the very small integrated circuit construction kind of thing, soldering pins of those that are right next to another one.
Or let alone surface mount devices.
Surface mount device, especially the little resistors that, you know, one sneeze and the whole kit is gone.
Oh, yeah. Try to find that resistor, which is almost microscopic, in your carpeting.
Right, exactly. Yes. Right. Yeah. I've tried to do that. In fact, I don't know how many I have in my carpet in the basement. So make sure that it all makes sense for you and your skill level. And you know, recognize that as you start doing kits, the skill level will improve. And the fact that there's something you might not want to make now, perhaps when you've made a few other kits, you'll be able to. Another thing that's possible is there's something that has steps that you're uncomfortable with. In some cases, there are aftermarket people who will actually perform those steps for you. I'm thinking about some kits that require winding of toroidal inductors, for example, which is not that fancy to do, but it's tedious, perhaps. There are people who will put together all the inductors for you for a price, and that's something to consider also. But make sure you have identified how you're going to do the construction or get somebody else willing to do it for you before you start.
Well, when you mentioned looking at the instructions, and you're talking about the kind of equipment that is going to be required to build this kit, beyond a soldering iron, beyond a screwdriver, let's say, if you're reading through the instructions and you hit a line that reads, "Next, plug in your spectrum analyzer," and you That would make me at least go, huh?
Yeah. Well, that's true. And the other thing is that's why I say picture doing these steps, because it may say, well, you need long nose pliers and a screwdriver. Well, that's true, but you probably would also be helped a lot by having a magnifying visor or a light.
Oh, good point.
So think about the other things. You'll need for most modern kits, you need a electrostatic discharge mat. It will keep you from blowing up your components as you handle them. And you have to know how to handle them, too. I mean, they tell you about that in the instructions. But look at the instructions. Some instructions are not very detailed. You know, take this bag of parts and put them together and plug it in.
Yes.
I mean, that...
Well, I'm not kidding. I have built a couple of those kits. Yes.
And that's fine if you're comfortable with that. There's nothing wrong with that. But just that's why you want to look first and make sure you're going to be comfortable with what you find. Some kits come with pre-drilled circuit boards and pre-mounted surface mount components and integrated circuits.
Oh, I love those.
Yeah.
When I see pre-mounted surface mount components, that's a huge plus for me.
That would, for me too, because my fingers are just bigger than most components.
Oh, yeah.
And I've dealt with them, but I'm more comfortable with the old-fashioned kind, I must admit. So, you know, make sure you're getting what you think you're going to get. Now, when you get the order, first thing you do is you very carefully read the instructions again, and then inventory and sort all the parts. In some cases, the kits are cleverly packaged so that you have multiple subassemblies, and all the parts for a particular subassembly are together in one package, and you only have to open that one to work on that subassembly. Then you put that aside, you do the next one. Whereas other ones, you get all the parts at once.
Yes.
And it's much harder to come out even at the end with that kind of an arrangement. But it's what I do in either case. I steal from the kitchen a muffin pan with the little, I don't know, 2.5-inch diameter muffin holes in them or whatever they are. Not holes, but
yeah, depressions.
Depressions, yeah. And that's a great place to put hardware. And you can put all the number 8 screws of a certain length in one and nuts in another and so forth all in a row. And then have another one for the electronic components. And that way you have some hope of keeping things straight. Another thing that some people like to do is take a cardboard box and cut it so it has a smooth surface with the corrugations showing. You can actually stick resistors and capacitors, things with leads on them, not the surface mount. All the surface mount ones would disappear into the cardboard. You'd never be seen again. But the one, things with leads on them can go in there, and you can actually write on the edge of the cardboard what the component is. So 3 days later, when you get to that component, you can remember which it is. Because sometimes it's very hard to tell. You know, some things are standard color code, and that's relatively easy, but some of them have a numerical code which might not be intuitive. Hopefully the instructions tell you which thing it is.
In my opinion, Joel, the best written instructions define all that explicitly. For example, it'll say the 0.1 microfarad disc, ceramic disc capacitor is labeled 103 or something similar.
Yes, exactly.
So I don't have to guess, although that 103 may require significant magnification for me to read. Yes.
Yeah, that magnification is a key thing, especially with the small solid state stuff. It's really important, not only for finding things and putting them together, but also to make sure that when you solder a component, that the solder is just with that component and not bridging over to another land on the printed circuit board. And that raises another point. Make sure, you know, he says you need a soldering iron. Well, make sure you have a soldering iron with the right point diameter and the right temperature range. The best type are thermostatically controlled, which you can set to a particular temperature. If you have too hot an iron, what can happen is, first of all, you can actually curl up the copper on the board and make
That
a real mess that's hard to deal with.
Ah.
But the other thing is you can damage components easily. You can also very easily, if the tip is too wide, it's very difficult to get solder on one pin of an integrated circuit socket and not have it cross over to another one. And it's important that you notice that when it happens and get rid of it. Otherwise, you spend a lot more time troubleshooting than you did building.
Yes.
And that's no fun when there's 7 layers of things above it. So you got to stay on top of all that and make sure you have all the right stuff to do it. Now, some kits, my current transceiver, for example, was a mechanical assembly only, which...
So the boards are already... populated with capacitors and what have you, transistors.
Not only that, but they're tested.
Yes.
So it's just a matter of putting it all together. What's nice about that is it's not as challenging in some ways, but anytime you want to do an upgrade or a modification to the equipment, you're more comfortable tearing it apart because you've been there. You've had it all apart, so you know how to.
Right.
Even though you might not enjoy doing it, you at least aren't scared of tearing it apart and breaking it because you know you've been there and it's been known to come together before.
Yes. Well, Joel, let's take a brief break here from DX Engineering, okay. And we shall return.
All right.
Remember your first contact? The excitement of that first CQ? The exhilaration of making your first QSO? At DX Engineering, we know that feeling too. That's why we've committed to making your on-air experience the very best it can be. DX Engineering ships quickly, which means less station downtime. And we have free shipping for almost any order over $99. We've recently expanded our inventory, so you don't have to wait for the gear you need. DX Engineering has introduced all new radio products and revived legendary brands, all with the goal of helping you enjoy amateur radio. Most importantly, the DX Engineering team is here to help you. You've got a team of highly experienced hams ready to work out technical issues, answer questions, and help you optimize your station performance. That excitement you felt from the first contact, it can happen again and again with help from DX Engineering. DXEngineering.com. That's DXEngineering.com.
And we're back, Joel. Something else about kits I wanted to bring up just quickly. It's a bugaboo of mine. Enclosures.
Oh, yes.
I love a kit that comes with its own enclosure. If you want me to pick out a metallic enclosure of my own and mount the kit within it, that means I've got to drill holes for potentiometers and whatnot, and I am just awful at working metal, so I dread that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. Make sure you know what you picture what you're going to end up with, and make sure it's what you really want. And another thing is think about is how to actually do the assembly work itself. I mean, in my experience, it's important to work in short intervals so you can maintain your attention span and you aren't drifting off into thinking about what you're going to be doing next about something else. I have a rule that I never work on a kit after cocktail hour. So I find things fit together much better before cocktail hour than after. Then I also have a rule that I double check every step as I go and check it off and make sure that I have the components that I am supposed to in that particular location and that the locations of each end of the component, if that's the kind of component.
Well, it's always a little scary to finish the building process and then realize you've got resistors and capacitors still scattered all over the place. I wonder where the...
Well, it reminds me of the people that used to make electronic equipment. Some of the big manufacturers used to have a whole department, I think, that spent time taking components out and seeing if it still worked.
Yes. And you mentioned that. Yes. Yes.
And they would win great awards and save a nickel here and a nickel there. And after a while, it adds up to serious money, especially if you make millions of them. So it can work without all the components, but probably would work better with them because the people that put the kits together probably try not to put extra components in.
Right. Exactly. And many of the kit suppliers now are ham radio clubs. Very small operations, just a few people. They build these kits. Sometimes we review them in QST. We had one not too long ago that you may remember this. It was a 80-meter transceiver. It was not tunable, just had a crystal, and it had coils that were actually on the printed circuit board itself rather than, say, toroids or what have you. And I built that particular kit, and it was only $30, but boy, that was just a lot of fun. It wasn't, you didn't end up with a fabulous transceiver, but I put power to it, little 9-volt battery, made contacts. It was wonderful. Even after all these years in the hobby, it was still a thrill.
Yeah, the kits can be a lot of fun. You always learn something from them. You get bragging rights and all kinds of things, too. It's good.
Well, are you ready to handle a question?
I think I could.
Bill, WB2HLM, asks, I thought your recent discussions about linear amplifiers and vacuum tube applications were excellent, but I wonder if you could also discuss ALC and amplifier keying, particularly in the context of using vacuum tube linears with modern solid-state transceivers. That's a good question.
It is, and it's, I have to say that when we were talking about that, I was mostly thinking about external factors like getting power to the amplifier and having enough power handling capability in the antenna system and so forth. But the connection between the transceiver and the amplifier is equally important, and there may be some big issues to consider there. The transmit-receive switching function is probably the most critical because the typical solid-state transceiver does not use relays to trigger the push-to-talk or the transmit-receive function of the amplifier. And what that means is they're designed to switch relatively low amounts of current and have a relatively low maximum voltage that they can switch.
Yes.
In contrast to the vacuum tube amplifiers that were made back in the day when they were designed to work with vacuum tube transmitters and transceivers, that almost universally had heavy relay contacts designed to perform that function. So you get into something of a mismatch that the switching voltage and switching current requirements of the amplifier may be well in excess of what the transceiver can switch. And if you try to just hook them together, what you'll find is you wipe out the circuitry in the transceiver, which is an uncomfortable result, not to mention expensive. It's pretty easy to tell what the amplifier requires. If you don't put drive to it or anything, but just have it on, and you bring out the transmit-receive wires, put your voltmeter on it, and see what the voltage is, being careful not to blow up your meter by having the connections in the right direction and start at a high level, you might find it 100 and some odd volts easily. And that'll be the open circuit voltage that the switching arrangement has to deal with. Disconnect the meter, switch it to measure DC current, and put it back across the line. And again, not with your fingers, because that could be 150 volts or something, and measure the current. Now, what will happen is when you do that, of course, that will close the circuit, and you'll hear relays clunk, and the amplifier will switch to transmit. But it has no excitation, so it's not going to do anything. But just don't be surprised to hear some relays close. And make note of the current, and that is the current that the transceiver would have to deal with. Then get out your transceiver manual and look and see what its limits are on how much voltage and current it can handle. If you're lucky, it'll be compatible and you can just hook them up and you're good to go. But if not, there are a number of solutions. There's a fairly easy one, which particularly if you use a foot switch anyway. Heil makes a foot switch that has two separate switching elements in it. And when you put your foot on the switch, the first thing it does is it switches the one designed to do the amplifier. And then, after a little additional depression of the foot, switches the transceiver. So you avoid kind of hot switching while signals are there. And when you take your foot off the foot switch, it does the opposite sequence. That automatically causes the transceiver to switch after the amplifier is switched and vice versa, and doesn't require any electrical connection between the two. Your foot is the common thread between them. I thought that was kind of clever. But, of course, it requires using a foot switch, and not everybody's comfortable with that. The other thing you can do is you can buy a interface box. And there are a number of them around, and there have been many circuits in QST over the years describing how to make that happen. So have the transceiver switch something it can do, and then there's typically a relay in the box that switches the amplifier. And that's a very straightforward project to do usually. You somehow have to make sure you have voltage to drive the relay and so forth, but that's easy to do. Or you can actually buy a box that will do that. I noticed our sponsor, DX Engineering, happens to list a couple of them, and there are, I'm sure, others around. So having a box in between the transceiver and the amplifier can solve the problem. Some of them even actually do full break-in CW as well. That's sort of a separate function. Anyway, among those different steps, you can definitely find a way to make your newer transceiver key your older amplifier if it's not compatible. The other thing you're asking about is automatic level control. Now, for those that aren't familiar with it, automatic level control is a lot like automatic gain control in a receiver, in that if signals are too strong, it reduces the gain of the system to make them down to the level they should be. This is designed to avoid having your transceiver overdrive your amplifier, because if you overdrive the amplifier, as many people do, and you can tell right away,
absolutely,
you generate distortion and wide signals and make people unhappy with you. The linear amplifier has an output jack labeled ALC that puts out a voltage that indicates the level of the signal, and you can use that to put back into the transceiver if the voltages are compatible and the levels are correct. And that will reduce the gain of the transceiver, so the transceiver can't overdrive the amplifier. But you have to set everything up just right.
So in a way, the amplifier is kind of controlling the transceiver after a fashion.
It is, exactly right. The way to do it, though, the best way to do it, is to not have it in normal operating control of the transceiver, but have it as a safety mechanism. Set the transceiver up so that the way you operate it normally has just the right amount of drive to the amplifier, and that's the way it's supposed to work. And then the ALC doesn't have to come in to play at all.
Right. Yes.
But the ALC is there if, for some reason, you stub your toe or something and say something really loud or really nasty into the microphone, or the cat comes up and meows. Something unusual happens. The ALC is there to keep you from overdriving and potentially even damaging your amplifier by hitting it too hard with the input signal. So ALC is a good thing to use as a safety mechanism. It doesn't respond so well to normal operation, like your normal speech kind of thing, because after all, it really almost has to be overdriving before it knows that it's overdriving. And if that happens, then you're in the overdrive mode and you're making a splattery signal, you know, much of the time. So just save it for times when something strange happens. Don't make it part of your usual operating experience. Have that all happen in the transceiver itself and make sure that stays within its own ALC range. And that should work much better.
Very good. Thank you, Joel.
My pleasure.
ARRL, The Doctor Is In, is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. For more information on amateur radio or the ARRL, visit us on the web at www.arrl.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for ARRL. If you have a question or comment for the doctor, send an email to doctor@arrl.org. Background music is courtesy of Ben Sound at www.bensound.com. This program is provided under the copyright of the ARRL. Until next time, I'm QST Managing Editor Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY 73, and thanks for listening.